We know we can count on Colin Fleming, who joins us every Tuesday afternoon, and he is with us right now. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, what's up, Kimmel?
Well, I was reading your piece on the Many Moments More blog, as you pointed out quite accurately, that the Boston Bruins hauled in as many postseason trophies and awards last night as they got postseason victories.
Yeah, people can go read it. Kind of leave the blog aside, but I didn't watch the awards ceremony. I don't think there were really any surprises. You pretty much knew that their players and their coach were going to pick up Jack Adams, the Selke, and the Vezina. Three victories, three playoff wins. Does a lot right there, doesn't it?
Absolutely. All right, let's talk Anton Chekhov today. We've got four of his short stories to discuss, and let's begin with Gooseberries, a man who wants to tell a friend a story about his brother.
Yeah, and Chekhov is one of those writers, I think people who don't read that often or they hear that phrase, great literature, there's a certain amount of foreboding. They think, oh, I'm not going to get this. It's going to go over my head, or I wasn't an English major or anything like that. Chekhov is one of those writers where it's like, it's okay, man. It's going to be fine. Just come along for a read, and I'm going to show you life as life is. Life as you go around and experience life. I'm just going to underline some stuff that maybe you would look past. I mean, that's really what a lot of great writing is. Everything is out there. It's all to be seen, and then someone comes along and says, take a look at this over here. What do you think about that? Pretty revealing, right? So this particular story is a meditation on happiness and what happiness can mean. Is happiness an absolute? Is it something that comes down to an individual person? So the thing that is terrible to the one individual, it may in fact be terrible, makes them happy, but everyone else might be repulse. Is then that true happiness, which suggests that ignorance is, it's really useful, but I can't really believe that an ignorant life is a life well lived. So we have a veterinary surgeon who is telling, as you said, his buddy about his younger brother. And his younger brother had this ambition in life to go back to what his childhood was like. So many people, right? All these people who collect toys and live it over again, essentially, and have this childhood dish that he enjoyed back in the day of gooseberries. And the narrator thinks this is the most depressing thing ever when he goes to visit his brother. And partially why it's so depressing to the narrator, it's just depressing as a concept, but it's depressing how happy he is compared to the narrator and everybody else.
And there's a great line in here. His brother does acquire some wealth, so he's able to have those gooseberries, but he says money like vodka can play queer tricks with a man. I love that.
It really can. Money, vodka, privilege, power. You probably experienced this, still experience this during, I don't know how much stories you can say out of school, right, as the old expression goes, but when you're within any system, people crave power, no matter what the system is, right? Whether it's the faculty at a school. I remember working at a Starbucks one summer home from college. There was a whole hierarchy there, like the building condo board. There's always that officious person, right? Like the president, who actually thinks like they're a combo of George Washington and Napoleon Bonaparte, and they live that up. And this guy has the means, and he waxes poetically about where he lives. He has all these sort of highfalutin terms, and this slop comes to him served by, like, his equally fat chef. They're just like these two bulbous guys. And it's like the pinnacle of the romantic life. He's in his own private utopia, and his brother wants to hurl. Like, he can't handle this. And he sort of comes away from the entire scenario. It's why he's telling the story. There's a need for him to tell this story. There's an unburdening that has to take place for this guy that he's just so taken aback. He can't wrap his mind around it. You ever find yourself doing that? You say things to people or you say things to yourself, either aloud or in your head, trying to convince yourself as to how they can be possible. That's what he's doing. So the story has real I don't know if it's therapeutic, but it has some utility for the narrator. You can make the argument that if someone's going to tell a story in the first person, it has to be about them in some way. And I think that's true. Even something like The Great Gatsby, it sort of looks like third person, but it's really first person. That's because it says a lot about Nick Carraway. So that's Chekhov, who's quite a Fitzgerald-esque writer in his way, just as Fitzgerald is a Chekhovian sort of writer, even though they use different sentence structures and lengths and all that. I think that's kind of what he's getting at here. It's rich. It's a very rich story. And yet, if you just laid it out on a note card to somebody, like a guy bitches about his brother, doesn't really get on with him that well, thinks he's like this pompous ass who shouldn't be as happy as he is, eats this gooseberry slop, and yet we see what's happening behind the veil. We're seeing real aspects of how humanity functions.
Do good. That's a pretty good message for anybody to take.
It is. And you know what? I was talking to my mother today. I was telling her about something, and finally I just stopped myself. I said, "You're obviously upset. What has happened today?" And she started walking me through this scenario of something that was said to her, and it was close to her heart, and she took it in a certain way, and she started not responding in a wrong way, but she started making these decisions. And I said to her, well, it's sort of a chain event, how we behave. Any behavior is sort of the result of a chain series of thoughts that led up to it. What I try to do in everything I do, every action and every word, because words are action, is I try to evaluate the value. What is the value of me saying this? I do that all the time. If I'm going to put something up there about somebody on the blog or whatnot, what is the value? What is the value in saying no to this person, yes to this person, being candid about this, not being candid? That's what Chekhov is getting at here, evaluating value. Everything should be an evaluation of what is the point? Is it worth saying this? Is it worth doing this? What am I hoping to achieve? Make decisions. And Chekhov excels, too, at making characters, at least the narrator of this story, make decisions, even when they're decisions of judgment. And that's okay, too. We're like, oh, judgment's bad. No. You have to make determinations in order to accrue knowledge in advance.
We're talking with Colin Fleming about some of the short stories of Anton Chekhov here on Downtown. The story Misery is so good, so powerful. We've talked with you a lot about the notion of friendship, connections, and how so many people don't actually have those real friends, those real connections in their life. And in this story, Iona simply wants to talk to someone about the death of his son, but that's hard to find.
Chekhov is so efficient as a storyteller. He, as you said, has this character who has lost his son and wants to, again, unburden himself. It's perfect that he is a cab driver. He's picking up his fares. So the notion of the captive audience, if you will. When I was at the monument the other day, we were all waiting to go in, and there was a line before they opened the door at 11 o'clock. So we're all standing there, and out comes one of the rangers, and he just starts expatiating about history and making bad jokes, and it's painful, and people are laughing, and I'm sort of resenting them because I'm thinking, are you fake laughing? You're that insincere, or are you that stupid, and you find this funny? I'm bouncing around on the balls of my feet. I'm ready to charge up to the top and all of this stuff. I'm thinking, this guy really has us captive, sort of like the main character of Misery has his various fares captive. You'd think that they could listen to this guy because he's had this loss that is as enormous a loss as you can have. And I've noticed something that is more true now than I think it used to be, that people don't have platonic relationships. They get married. They still kind of know some people from a distance, but they put their back to the world, and their immediate family becomes their sole network of relationships. They talk to their parents every now and again and update them on their brood. But people don't have friends, and they don't make friends. And friendship really, as we've spoken about before, to me, it undergirds everything of consequence. It undergirds the father-child, mother-child dynamic. In a way, it undergirds the artist-audience relationship in its way. And so he's just simply trying to talk about this thing that's happened to him. And people's attention wanders into their own lives. And Chekhov gives us these details where there's this hunchback, and he's saying, oh, not everyone's long for the world. It's just how it works out sometimes. And he has, like, the hunchback cough and wipe the corner of his mouth with the back of his sleeve. You get the sense that he's not long for the world. Chekhov doesn't say, hey, this guy's projecting, but he shows it to us in all of these deeds and these words that people don't even know that they're giving themselves away with. So ultimately, in the end, this main character does a version of the unburdening. Who does he unburden himself to? Ironically, the beast of burden in his horse. It's like I said a moment ago, we find ourselves talking to ourselves. We find ourselves making notes. You use that note function on your phone, and you try to work through an idea, or you write in a journal. This man talks to his horse.
When you talk about friendship and the lack that many people have of close, good, real friends, I wonder if there's a gender difference in that. It seems to me that women are able to do largely a better job of that than men. And I don't know if that's because of men's fear of intimacy or this, you know, idea of the macho notion that you don't talk about feelings or emotions or important things if you're a man.
I think they do too. Although it's like someone has to finish first. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I don't know that they excel at it. I don't think anyone does. I think it goes to the nature of our highly performative society. In order to have a friend, you need to be open and vulnerable and honest. Most people don't like those things, right? Everyone plays a role in things like the 77% of the adults in this country on Twitter and all of this stuff and social media and what they like and what they don't like. It's not because they actually like it. There are a lot of other things that are happening. There are a lot of agendas and motivations and ways that they want to portray themselves. I think that a lot of the best things of consequence in this world are feminine in nature. I think art is what we typically think of as feminine in nature. That doesn't mean that it's not equally for men and women and children and sprites and spirits and everything, but there is an openness. There's a vulnerability. There's a vulnerability to these Chekhov stories. That's why I don't like Hemingway. Hemingway was so insecure. He's like, look how brawny and masculine I am, but ultimately I'm super weak, but I don't want you to know because I have this whole persona I'm trying to maintain. And someone like F. Scott Fitzgerald was more feminine in these matters, and he wanted to be Hemingway's friend very much. And Hemingway, meanwhile, is saying, like, oh, I saw your member the other day in the shower. There's no way it can satisfy your wife. You should work on that. Because he was so insecure. That was an actual conversation. He was so insecure himself. And that's why Fitzgerald's art has endured in a way that Hemingway's has dated. So Orson Welles said much the same thing. The best art is feminine. It doesn't mean that it can't be bold and striving and all of these things, but it needs to have that core vulnerability. It needs to be able to strip naked and say, hey, here I am. This is how it's going to be. This is what it looks like. You need to accept this because it's real.
Up next, a terrific story entitled Children that involves kids gathered around to play a game of lotto. Big money. Several kopecks on the line here in this one. But I love the way that the game means something different to each one of these children.
Writers make the mistake of thinking that something that's going to be written about, even though they just usually do narcissistic drivel, has to be grand. They don't understand that grandeur is around us again everywhere if we choose to see it. These are, well, it's primarily five kids. An older kid, a teenager, shows up at one point and joins in on this game. But they're just kind of home, and they're playing this game at night. Kids of all ages, different demeanors within this family. We get a world. Chekhov understood that there are worlds within the world, and he located them with incredible judgment, vision, acumen, virtuosity in his prose. The characters are all motivated by different things. There's that person, for instance, who's like, I want, I'll cut your throat to win. I'll cheat. I want this. Whatever. I need this. Trust me. It's important. There is someone who takes pleasure in the successes of everyone else, like a sort of benevolence. There is the stolid seeming person who is holding back how thrilled they are that they get to hang out and be a part of this group. And that's really what they want. You have the teenager that I had mentioned who shows up and may or may not be up to no good and thinking they can rip off these little kids and whatnot. And ultimately, a world plays out. A community plays out. We see these motivations. Chekhov is never just showing us five children. He's showing us ourselves. He's showing us everyone we know. He's showing us everyone we'll never meet. He's showing us everyone who hasn't been born yet. That's what the great prose artist does. That's what it's about. It's not about these five kids, although it's so about these five kids at the same thing. That's the brilliant dichotomy that you have to be able to pull off. And then how does it end? Of course, neutrally. They all collapse in a heap, like a familial heap, and the game is effaced from existence, save as this memory that is probably already passed in two of them, and they move on to whatever the next game will be. It's like, I don't know what more someone could want from a reading experience that's just so relevant to you, whoever you are, whether you are a kid or you have kids or you'll never have kids or you've seen a kid or there's a kid in some capacity still that remains inside of you. And so it's timeless.
And the game is such a great device because I think playing games reveals an awful lot about our character.
It does, and especially when you cease to play games. I find myself, like, if I'm going to the monument and there are puddles and there's, like, a rock at my foot, it's just habitual that I'll, no matter how awful things are, I'll kick that rock and I'll try to make it go all the way through as many puddles as I can in a row. And it seems like such a small thing, but it speaks to... The game is always within. For Sherlock Holmes, the game was afoot. But really, a game is synonymous with that notion of play. And play is synonymous with the notion of imagination. And imagination is synonymous with the idea of empathy. When we think of what someone else is going through, we enter their lives through a concerted effort of imagination. It's a form of play, of going beyond ourselves, which is what a game is. So you can't devalue the import of a game or of play. You can't dismiss them as like mere childhood things that are to be put aside. And again, that's something crystallized in this story, because it's not like, oh, I'll just write this story about stupid games kids play and how some kids cheat and some kids are happy that they get to be included. He's always giving us more. He's not telling us more. He's pulling aside the curtain and saying, have a look, go ahead, take a peek, see what's going on there. That's what's going on with all of us.
Finally, a wonderful story called Boys. A boy and his friend come home for the holidays, and then we eventually learn about their secret desire, their secret plan to make their way to a land of enchantment.
This is such an odd story. We've talked about weird and the idea of weird that works. The best art is weird, but it works. So it's not just being weird for the sake of being weird. This is almost like an avant-garde story, wouldn't you say?
Very much so.
That these two kids, like, you know how it is. You bring your buddy home with you for the Christmas holiday, and these guys are being asked questions, and, like, the questions aren't really registering, and they're, like, looking out with this 500-yard stare and everything. Like, they've kind of lost their minds. And one of the kids is saying that he has like this really weird code name, essentially Montezuma, the hot clock. And the three sisters of the boy who brings this guy home, they're all weirded out. But the boys are like, you know what? We're going to go to California where people drink gin instead of tea. They're speaking in all of these cryptic expressions. It's like, are you high? What's happening here? And we're going to get the gold. So, like, the three sisters, they're like, oh, okay. Well, we shouldn't tell mom and dad, because if they come back with the gold, they might cut us in. I mean, it's so imaginative. Can you, like, even, there's just no stories written like this now. If you describe this to someone, I was writing this, and, like, they were someone within a writing community, they wouldn't know what to do with that. They'd fall apart. So it turns out that the two boys, they make a break for it. I love that they do that. And, like, the next day, they're apprehended. But there's more to this story. There's, like, they were looking for ammo, and they're, like, had a gun. And it's just, so the parents are like, all right, this, we're not doing this anymore. You, visitor, you're out. You're going home. And boy, we need to have some talking. So this sort of thing doesn't happen again. And so the boy, before he's sent away, the friend, he signs one of the sister's journal with his code name, Montezuma the Hot Claw. To always leave her with the reminder of this just weirdness. It's just so fresh and weird and alive. Sometimes the things that you hear that, oh, you can't make that up. I always think, oh, that's pretty cliched. That seems pretty easy to make up. The things that no one else could make up, but Chekhov could make up, they're really the most believable.
I love it when one of them asks one of the boys about California, where is it? He says, California's farther down. If once we can get to America, California will only be round the corner. We can make our living by hunting and highway robbery.
I know, and highway robbery. So you can just be like some stand and deliver. I guess that's what the gun is for. So again, it begs all these questions like, all right, this is fanciful and this is nuts, and these kids are like sniffing glue or drinking codeine or whatever they're doing, right? Yet they have a plan. It's not just for a lark. It's like, we'll do this. This is what we need to get first. Then we need some gunpowder. I mean, they've actually worked something out. It's not just for this whim. Presumably, I don't know. You don't know. It's a great like conversation for the class. Were they going to go off and just do target practice at a tree because that's what boys do and they happen to get this pistol? Or were they looking to board a steamer and actually cross? You have to cross a lot. I mean, frankly, to go from Russia to California. I mean, are you going west? You're going east. I guess you're just going east. But still, you have the Pacific. That seems challenging. And I love how the girls, the sisters, at first they're so skeptical, but then they're convinced, they're awestruck. You can win people over with the size of your tale that you're telling, and it speaks to how impressionable people are. He's getting at a lot of things that, you know, you ever see those satire sites, like on the internet, and they say it's just the most outlandish thing, and then you run into the first 300 people in the comments section, it's so depressing, who take it literally, and they think it's really true. Like, there were all of those people when Swift was like, you know what, we have a problem with the food. Let's just cook some kids. We'll serve them up. It'll be fine. Sure. You win some, you lose some. It's kind of like Misery. Like, hey, everyone dies. Everyone lies. Might as well get on with it. And people are like, you can't be eating the kids, Swift. Like, people really like believe that. Like, dumbasses. Chekhov is not really so great if you're a dumbass. But I think one thing that you teased out, too, is just how funny this is. This is like truly funny in a weird way. It's funny even just to talk about it and the guy's weird ass name for himself. How did he come up, Montezuma? Like, where did he even get that? So there's nothing dated about this. It's as fresh as the day our Russian friend wrote it.
And Chekhov did not live a long life. He only made it to 44. He didn't expect to live a long life, apparently. Was he better known in his time for his short stories or for his remarkable plays?
He did fairly well with each. He would have self-identified as a doctor. Died at 44. A lot of people around that age, whether it's Van Gogh, Billie Holiday, F. Scott Fitzgerald, everyone talks about 27. But like that 44 area, it gets a lot of great artists for whatever reason. With Chekhov, the reason was tuberculosis. But these stories, it speaks to what a different time it was, too, that people would read, that was their entertainment, and these stories would come out, and they'd be reviewed as individual stories, and that is not presently how things happened, and then he was doing the drama, but I love Chekhov. He's one of my favorite artists. He means lots to me, and as much as I appreciate and read and reread his plays, he so knew what he was doing with short stories. It reminded me of something that Bruce Pratt had said about a short story that I'd done once, that you could just as easily call it a novel. And that's what I want when I read a short story from someone. I don't want to be able to necessarily just have to call it a story. And there's so much life in these works. What is the distinction? Are we just calling something a novel based on word count? Because sort of the implication is it's called a novel because it contains so much. Well, what happens if you have a story that's 3.5 pages long that contains more than almost any other novel? What are we doing with labels then? And Chekhov, he was confronted with this. People are like, you're doing new things, man. This can't be done. And he's like, I can do it. It's not my responsibility to give you things that you've already had. It's your responsibility to deal with what's happening with the newness I'm creating. You have to have that attitude if you're doing anything of consequence that isn't a retread.
Well, if you haven't read any of the Chekhov short stories, my goodness, please do. If you have, but maybe you haven't read them since college, dive back in. You will love it because they're every bit as vibrant now as they were back in the late 1800s. Colin, we thank you. As always, we're on show vacation next week, so we'll catch up with you 2 weeks from today.
All right. Happy 4th, Kimball. Enjoy those sparklers.